John Semedo, Long Paul Semedo, Jonathan Semedo. He actually sort of let slip during one of his talks in the meditation room that it's tough being the leader of a worldwide religious organisation. And that is, of course, what he is. And sometimes I keep having to remind myself of that because he is so approachable and friendly and nice. And I'd like to take this opportunity of saying, you know, once again, and the more he doesn't, you know, it's still so very true every time I say it, we are so eternally grateful for him being with us, and he's going to speak to us again this evening. If you wouldn't mind. So.
They always used to stand and put our hands up
when a holy man came. That's very true.
Yes, very
true.
Flat.
Yes,
times we've changed that, isn't it?
Venerable Jesus and John and brothers and sisters in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and in Thailand we say brothers and sisters in old age, sickness and death, which is a very good reflection actually, because we all have this in common.
Yes.
These are the things of life, the facts of our existence. This is the last evening we have together, and I think, of course, all that comes together must separate, and one of the forms of suffering is to be separated from the loved, and so we'll be experiencing these dhammas tomorrow as we each go off to our own homes and places that we live. But it's always good to see the dhamma of our lives by just noting the coming together, the separation, and in just the ways that happens to us in daily life. Sometimes we make these into kind of melodramas that happen on television, but actually this is the way life is. It's always the meetings and partings, comings and going, birth and death, and this is just the way it is. With Buddha's teaching, when we contemplate the kind of the emphasis that the Buddha made was on the ability to understand things as they are. It's a teaching about the way things are from the wide perspective, from universal perspective. It's not about the details of the way things are and the infinite variety. It's about the general pattern, universal pattern, which is the mortal realm, the rising and ceasing, the impermanence of the conditioned realm that we're experiencing through our bodies and senses, and then the pattern of the relationship of the conditioned or the death-bound to the deathless, to the immortal, from mortal to the immortal. And so these are the two. These are that's a universal pattern. That's not a kind of somebody's idea that they made up, or it's not just a theory that the Buddha had. But he's pointing to the way things are. During this week, we've had many opportunities to listen to various speakers and to contemplate and reflect on the effects that we, the reactions we might have to what people say. It's interesting to ask people about what they felt about Douglas Hardy's talk, because people have different reactions. Some people can relate to it and some people can't. But the dhamma of the situation doesn't lie in whether you agree or disagree, but in the actual recognition of the reactions you might have, either being believing or thinking it was great or incredibly wise, or it was foolish, or you agree or you don't agree, or you just understand or you don't understand. When you put it in the terms, in the context of dhamma, then you see that whatever your reactions are, you're looking at them in that way. What arises ceases. So that's the pattern of this realm of conditioned phenomena, this mortal realm that we're born into. I recognize that all of us have been born, even though this is an obvious fact, because anyone who wasn't born wouldn't be here. but this also is something to contemplate, that we're here because of we've been born into this form, and then we, in some time in the future, this body will die. And that's the future, isn't it? Death is what we expect to experience in the future. And so, and right now is the experience of life, of consciousness, of feeling, of this realm of the mortal, of the death conditions. Now we tend to cling to the death conditions out of our ignorance, not understanding things properly. We identify, we attach, we cling to the things that are whose very nature is to change. And because of this, then we suffer, because we cannot make it otherwise. We can't make something death-bound into something deathless. We can't, even though we try to prolong our lifespan, maybe through various drugs or routines of life or diets or whatever, we might be able to extend lifespan for a while, but inevitably the body will die because it was born. And so the suffering then is really wanting our lifespan to continue, when we know that the lifespan of this body is not going to continue. When it reaches its end, then it's time for it to die. Then the question is, how do we get in touch with the deathless or the immortal? And this is the great religious question, isn't it? How do we reach into that? How do we realize that? How do we contact it? And this, of course, religions are all religions are an attempt to try to answer that question in various ways. And so, in say, theistic religion has its own doctrines, its own interpretations. And oftentimes the deathless or the immortal is not really recognized as something ineffable, but something that we try to believe in. We can to make a doctrine or an image of it. We conceive deathlessness, and then we attach to our conception. And this, of course, is one way of reminding ourselves of the deathless reality, because we do forget that, because we tend to get so caught up and overwhelmed by the realm of death that we're very much strongly influenced by at this time. The Buddha's approach was to develop a way of realizing deathlessness, which was not trying to conceive it or define it, or to try to in any way create a doctrine about the immortal or the deathless, but a very simple and direct realization of it. And this, to me, is the whole kind of the real essence of the Buddha Dhamma. That the Buddha, to me, was very successful in this, in allowing us to realize the immortal, or the in Pali words, Ammata Dhamma, or the deathless reality. You can say ultimate reality, or the absolute. These are words that we use to try to describe or to recollect or remember, because it's so easy for us to get whirled away and caught up into the habits of our thoughts, our conditioned mind. Now recognize that all of us are conditioned by life. From the when we're born, then we the mind is not conditioned. The natural conditions of a baby's body affect it, and so when it's hungry, it cries and so forth. But it's not. It has no sense of itself as being anything. It is what it is. And then, over the years, as we grow up, then of course we receive all kinds of suggestions, ideas, attitudes about what we are, what we should be. So we become all these things, and a child's mind is like a sponge. It just absorbs everything that comes its way. It doesn't have the wisdom yet to see what's real and what's true. It's merely taking on whatever is offered, whatever is given. So children, because of that, are, you know, we must recognize that they're quite precious, and they need to be respected, and we need to try to provide a proper way of maybe giving right good suggestions to them, because they're going to because they'll absorb anything that comes their way. Then we need to try to give them that which is really going to benefit them, rather than that which can cause them unnecessary suffering, or confuse them, or give them totally wrong impression of what they really are. Now we've all, even though this is quite kind of idealistic, it is, I think, you know, quite important to realize the effect of our own lives on our children, and the effect of modern education and fashions and attitudes, trends. All of this are being taken on by the innocent, because they're all available now. Children are quite free to see, to listen, to absorb all kinds of things that are really quite harmful to their welfare, because they don't have the ability yet to see that this is wrong, this is unskillful, this is unhelpful, and this is good, this is right, this will help me. They just more or less get it all, and hopefully they can, you know, they can learn to sort it out later, as many of us have had to do. Now, the recognize that some, the suggestions of the Buddha are very skillful, like to say anatta, rather than atta or self. The Buddha isn't trying to convince you, you know, that you have to believe that you don't exist. But he's pointing to the fact that whatever arises ceases, and that its nature is to change and to appear and disappear, and therefore you can't regard anything in that way as being your real self. You can see it maybe as a temporary experience at best, but then to be thoroughly attached and identified to views and memories, opinions, prejudices and so forth, the bodies we have, the emotional reactions and tendencies we have, and we identify with all this, then of course we see it in terms of it being kind of permanently ours rather than just temporarily ours. it's easy to assume that anger, hatred, or lust, or all kinds of say, unwanted emotions are kind of permanent possession of ours. And we oftentimes describe ourselves as being an angry person, or a jealous type, or a person with a lot of fear, or we can hold to these perceptions of ourselves as if this was an ongoing, solid thing that we were born with and that we'll die with. And that we can assume that our personality and our neurotic tendencies and habits are what we really are. This is me, this is the way I am. But on reflection, when we really observe and witness to it, we see that these things are just, they come and go. They arise and cease in the mind. And we're watching it now in terms of it as Dhamma, what arises and ceases, rather than as self, which the self view is the view of I'm an angry person, here comes anger again, see, this proves that I'm angry, then I blow up and I say something in anger, then you say, I've been tomatoes, an angry person, and then I say, yes, I certainly am. and then you think, well, he needs to go to a psychiatrist, and go off to a psychiatrist, and I said, the problem with you, tomatoes, you've got a problem with anger, you have a lot of resentment from past experience, and maybe you should go through some kind of therapy. Now this time, it seems like, you know, I really am this on a permanent basis. But on further reflection, you see that sometimes anger rises and then it ceases. But also, there a lot of our lives, there's no anger. And you can, and in, with mindfulness, way of mindfulness and reflectiveness on the way things are, you begin to notice the moments of non-anger as well as anger. Can you say non-anger? I'm a non-angry person because some moments there's no anger. All you can say is that there's no person there. It's just sometimes this way, sometimes it's that way. And then the because of that, you begin to put anger, say, just as one example, in a context of Dhamma. You're seeing it as it really is, rather than with the fear, with the aversion, with the anxiety, with the neurosis, and all the things that we complicate our lives with. Suddenly you can let go of that stuff, and you can learn to just learn to be more patient and learn how to let go of these things and not make problems about them. Now it sounds easy enough when talking about, especially when you're not angry, but the real test is when you're really angry. And, like, it's always easier to give advice to somebody else, you know? Because you don't, you know, somebody else is in a terrible state, and it's very easy to tell them how to deal with it. But when you're in that state, it's different, isn't it? You're not that cool. You can't be that distanced from it. Because you're feeling it right here, your body, your emotions, or, you know, you're feeling the whole thing, and it sets off, it triggers off all kinds of other things, all kinds of reactions of self-criticism or blame or whatever, and it gets very complicated. So, let's say in meditation, in Vipassana meditation, for example, we use the four foundations of mindfulness. These are kind of they're foundations, they're bases for reflection or contemplation. And these, of course, are the body, the body we have is the first foundation of mindfulness. You begin to contact your body again, rather than just be caught in the kind of emotional reactions to fear or anger. You begin to note what it does to the body. You take an interest. You study. You examine the body that is affecting your mind. Now we tend to, many of us, have developed a life, in the early part of our life that was very much in the head, with ideas and thoughts, and unless you're a particularly physical person. you may not have really given your body much attention. And I, one of being one of these kind of people that lived in my head, loved to think and read, and could spend, you know, spend my life as a child daydreaming up in upstairs, and quite out of touch sometimes with the rest of it. And of course, this was even encouraged in the kind of society I was in. You were encouraged to read and to develop your intellect, and the body was regarded as not really terribly that worthwhile to study and examine. So unless you were, you know, wanting to make yourself attractive sexually attractive or vanity, you take an interest in your appearance. But that's not Gyanupassana Saripatthana, not vanity, or the reflection on the body. Reflection on the body is recognizing it for what it is. And so we have various ways of just contemplating it and just bringing into our consciousness the fact that we have feet, we have hands, we have fingertips, we have soles of the feet, we have a top on the head, we have we begin to note this and begin to use the body we have just to begin to recognize the top of one's own head. Just by thinking the top of the head, you can actually experience your own top of the head. Or just by thinking the little toe on my right foot. Suddenly you can contact the little toe on your right just by thinking about it. It's this kind of sweeping practice where you start from the top of the head and go down to the soles of your feet and back up again, where you're just noting the various parts of your body, bringing them into your consciousness. So like being born in a human form means that we're conscious, separate entities experiencing consciousness. And consciousness is something that is the result of birth. So consciousness then can be used and as a tool for understanding Dhamma. So we bring things, the mortal world, into our consciousness in all its, whatever it is, good, bad, high, low, refined, coarse, whatever form, whatever state, conditions might be, we can make them conscious. And in that allowing things into our consciousness with that invitation or accepting them for what they are, we don't make karma with them anymore. We resolve the karma we have with them by bringing them into our consciousness. Now, for example, the body we have, when we bring it into consciousness, the various parts of it, one can even reflect on the internal organs, try to feel what the kind of energies that go through your body, or reflect on the skeleton or the blood or these things that are within this body, but which we don't identify with through vanity or really think about until maybe something happens. We break a leg or we start bleeding, and then we tend to be frightened by and reactive in a negative way to our own blood. Now, some people faint when they see their own blood coming out. And yet this is we just experience it as something frightening and unwanted, rather than as seeing it as just the way things are. That this body, when punctured, then blood squirts out of it. It's just the way it is. And we can even contemplate. I've used to have a meditation on blood, on my own blood, imagining my blood circulating through the body in color red. Red's a very, I'm good at visualizing color, so red is a very kind of startling color. And to imagine that inside this sack of flesh is all this red fluid zooming around. It's a different way of reflecting on yourself, isn't it? One doesn't think of it in that way until you start developing ways of seeing what's happening, because that's what's happening within all these bodies here. Sometimes in we contemplate the non-beauty of the body. When we call these super practices, where we bring into consciousness the fact that the body is not when we take it apart bit by bit, it doesn't arouse a kind of sexual desires. To have sexual desire, you have to have this illusion that the body is very beautiful and attractive. And then when you start looking at it in other ways, then sexual desire tends to diminish. Because the power of lust is it overwhelms your discriminative faculties. When you're full of lust, you lose all power of discrimination. And you just get carried away. When lust is dominant in your mind, then the whole thing is to get what you want. And some people lose all discrimination. They'll do, you know, sense of shame or fear of breaking the law or respect for another person. They'll just be completely carried away by lust, such as people that are lost in kind of rapists or people that are just overwhelmed, that cannot think of any of the results of that kind of activity, because that is a very powerful mental state, and so because it does destroy discrimination, then people that have that problem, lustful people, that are encouraged to develop more discriminative mind. So you start being hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. Then you get into the skeleton and the bone marrow and the liver and the kidneys and the spleen and the stomach and the bile and the blood, the mucus, and all the rest of it. And certainly this does not lust arousing. Developing a way of counterbalancing maybe the overwhelming tendency to be carried away by lust. Now, many of us have an opposite problem of being too critical. Our critical faculties are highly developed. So we can easily kind of see the unpleasant side of anything. We can pick up the unpleasantness of any the possibility of unpleasantness and pain and that in the experiences of life. And so we easily tend to, when we reflect on the body, we tend to see it in terms of its in terms of aversion rather than just discrimination, because we're already easily critical, and then that critical mind goes into a negative state of aversion. The body is bad, it's ugly, it's disgusting, it's foul. And some monks really love that kind of practice. I think it's some kind of perverse pleasure they get out of thinking how ugly and disgusting their bodies are, which is not good Dhamma either, is it? You're not really getting to really reflect on what's happening, you're merely being caught up in maybe your own tendencies and supporting it in various ways through your own interpretations of the scriptures. Then, say, the three other foundations of mindfulness are the like Vedana or feeling, and Citta, which is a mental state of the mind, and Dhamma, which is reflecting on the way things are in terms of Dhamma. So in Vedana and Citta, in Vedananupassana and Cittanupassana, one is beginning to reflect on just the attraction, aversion, and neutral feeling that we all experience. Because of our conscious state that we're in, and the sense realm that we're experiencing, we're both attracted and repelled through the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the body, and our mind. So we can begin to notice this rather than just react. We begin to reflect and observe and note, pay attention to the attractiveness of things or the repulsiveness of things or the neutralness of anything. Now, it's easy to note the attraction and the repulsion of things, the extremities of Vedana, but now we're also moving toward that middle ground of neither pleasurable nor painful, neither beautiful nor ugly. And the neutral Vedana, which generally is not acknowledged or not reflected upon, not seen, because unawakened person is always experiencing life from its extremities, and the ordinariness, the neutral experiences of life are never fully conscious, are never accepted as conscious in our consciousness. So notice that Buddhist meditation sometimes starts with mindfulness of the breath, which is of the breathing type for most people is rather neutral. It's neither pleasant nor painful. it goes on, it happens whether you're happy or sad, or whether you're a success or a failure, whether you're sane or insane, whether you're sitting, standing, walking, or lying down, you're breathing. And so the breath is something to note, to begin to move toward, just to bring into consciousness something that is going on that is not extreme. Then we note that the Vedana is impermanent. We're looking at it only from its characteristics, not from any judgments or value judgments about it. It's just pleasant Vedana is impermanent, neutral Vedana is impermanent, painful Vedana is impermanent. And you're not just trying to convince yourself, you're noting its presence and its absence. So that gives you a perspective on just the pull of the sense realm and the power of it to be attracted and repelled, and to be able to more and more feel at ease with the neutralness of life, because most of our life is neither pleasant nor painful, is it? It's just, life tends to, we tend to remember the extreme pleasure or pain, but the neutralness of it, when it's neither one way or the other, is not remembered, not noted. And so in developing awareness through training our conscious experience, we're noticing and we're beginning to feel a sense of being at ease with just being, with feeling and consciousness alone. We don't feel we have to always be running around. We can have a sense of being relaxed and at peace with just breathing and just being here and now. And that is quite a marvelous realization. Then jittanupassana is like the mood of your mind, the emotional reactions we have, where we're caught up in feelings of despair or depression or anguish or grief or elation or extreme kind of mental states. And of course we tend to identify strongly with those extreme mental states, but we don't really notice and note the neutral mental states, where we're neither high nor low, we're neither elated nor depressed, we're neither happy nor miserable, where it's just neutral. And so then we begin to acknowledge, say, the mind when there's not one extreme or the other, the mood is just kind of equanimous, where the feeling is neutral, where the body is no longer something that we're just reacting to, something that we're accepting for what it is. We've examined, we've studied, we've noted, we've learned from the body, and it's no longer, we're no longer assuming that it's me and mine. It is what it is. Then the Dhammapassana Satipatthana is, of course, the reflection on Four Noble Truths, the dependent origination, using the Dhamma teachings, so that this gives us a vocabulary and a way of understanding things that is non-personal. And I think this is very important because I noted, like, say, when I first came to England years ago at Chitchurst, we used to get these women who would come, and they were all very psychic people, and they'd talk about their psychic experiences. And of course, at first I didn't know what they were talking about, because the way they talked was so, they were trying to tell me something, but we didn't have a common language. They could only talk in a highly personal way, or in some kind of psychic jargon or whatever they were into, which didn't make any sense to me. And so I could either dismiss it or feel, well, they're talking about something I don't know about, or it would tend to get into kind of misunderstanding. And then I began to realize that one thing is that with Dhammanupassana, you're actually developing a language, like a way of communicating about very individual personal experience, but it's not filled with a kind of idiosyncratic language or concepts that no one else would comprehend or understand. Now, trying to describe an emotional experience with rational thought. This is... just try to describe and make your own emotional experience, some kind of strong emotional experience or neutral experience, and try to, so that somebody else knows exactly what you're talking about, and then you begin to realize that we can easily misunderstand each other. I notice like men tend to really like rational thought and logic, and we like to fix life into rationality, and then, because there's a kind of security in that, it's wonderful to have a kind of sensible conversation where everything is reasonable and rational, and you can all kind of agree or disagree on various issues, but it's all up here, and that can be very kind of makes one feel secure and safe. And then I remember one time when we first started the Order of Nuns and down at Chitchurst, and they all came to me one afternoon, and they were sitting in front of me, and they all started crying. And I just, you can relate to that. Did I do anything to upset them? Then I noticed that sometimes they tried to be explaining something to me about how they were feeling, and I would tend to, because they were talking in a personal way about what they were feeling, and I would tend to not understand what they were saying, because they didn't know how they were trying to describe an emotion rather than an ideal, and therefore it was easy to get them all wrong, or to just feel they were being foolish, or that we could dismiss. But then when one started doing Cittanupassana Satipatthana, and you started trying to explain your own emotional, trying to get in touch with your own feelings, then you began to see that this is something that is beyond explanation, and that you can't always put into some kind of rational perspective, but it is impermanent. It rises and ceases. And so then you're putting it, you're using the tamanupassana satipatthana, or it's the seeing the dhamma of it, that what is subject to arising is subject to ceasing. Now the entrance to the deathless is death itself, surprisingly. And so since all of us have experienced consciousness at this time, and we are you know, and things arise in our minds and then they cease. So we can't always control the arising, but we can become more aware of the cessation of the conditions in our mind. And so this is when developing the Eightfold Path, the Buddha was acknowledging this. As we understand the nature of our mind, and we begin to allow ourselves to experience the ending of conditions in the mind, then you're actually dying before you're dying. It's like you're letting things die. You're letting things go within your mind. And if you notice, sometimes it is like death when you're letting go something you really like. There's a sense of grief or a sorrow, of just a mental state that you'd like to hang on to and relive. And this is where sometimes in meditation it can be quite frightening, because we realize that it's sometimes we feel like we're dying, like that we're dying inside ourselves, and it can be rather terrifying. But when you're putting it in terms of Dhamma, then you're recognizing that the ending, what was pleasant, is ceasing, and you're letting it, you're not trying to get rid of it, you're letting it cease according to its nature. And in that cessation, then you realize the deathless, before your body dies. So this is why the Buddha was teaching, say, Nibbana, or this enigmatic way of talking about cessation, or the ending, or extinction, or words that can be taken in very much the wrong way, as a kind of absolute position. But it's merely the ending of what began. And of course, the realization of Nibbana is the realization of the amata, or the deathless reality. Interesting to contemplate just what it's like to be when there's no, when recognizing just the neutral state, where there's just awareness, consciousness, but there's no sense of yourself as being anybody. You're not in any caught up in kind of compulsive feelings in the moment. It's just this way, and yet that is what we tend to ignore and not note in any way, and yet there's no suffering in that moment, and we to suffer, that means we have to create something and attach to something to start suffering again. So once you begin to see what the cause of suffering is, then you can let go of the cause and realize the end of suffering. That's what I was noticing with the Ikebana, that Elizabeth was emphasizing the space. That's important in Buddhism, isn't it? The space. Because it's neutral. It has no, not red or blue, it's not beautiful or ugly. It's the spacious. The flowers, They might be pink or purple, and the shape of the leaves and the tall branch and the divine, the human and the earth, those are the forms. But notice the emphasis on the space. I think this is why I note here in Britain, when we have these more and more, it seems like people are recognizing that there's something, a kind of awakening, and I don't want to exaggerate it too much and get too optimistic, but more and more people have that awareness now. I mean, it's like a completion. It's not a denial or a destruction of the condition, but it's the relationship of the condition, of the form to the space, that we are beginning to notice now, where, say, before we didn't even notice that. We were just caught up in reacting to the conditions. So in reality, nobody ever really dies. Conditions cease. I'm not just saying that to make you feel good. That's something to contemplate. You know, what really dies, and what is deathless? Because we're not out of touch. Deathlessness is everywhere. It's nowhere, and it's everywhere. It's something you can't grasp. But you realize when you're not grasping anything.
You've still got a very expensive film to help with that. But I mean, you can now have a do-it-yourself film, which I'm looking into.
They had a great funeral at Amravati last February, then, where Upala, the old 91-year-old nun, died. Uh-huh. And she had a will, that she didn't want to be cremated, she wanted to be buried. So they actually got permission from the council in Hemel Hempstead to bury her in Amravati. So she's buried out in the Buddha Grove, out in the fields. And one of the monks, Venerable Subhuto, made the coffin. I didn't get to see it because I was away in Thailand at the time, but he said it was a very beautiful coffin made by one of the monks. And some of the laymen dug the grave. So it was all not very expensive. You
know. Well, I gather you can buy sort of coffins which you can then put together yourself. Then it was suggested that you arrange for four friends to carry it whenever it was suggested. But really, you see, to use wood like that and keep burning it is not very mindful, is it?
You can buy a biodegradable body bag now. No, seriously,
you can.
Well, is this Tom Esther?
Well, there's no reason why you shouldn't have a body bag and hire a coffin if you take it to the crematorium, is there?
But there is, in fact, no legal obligation in this country to have a funeral at all.
Oh,
you can just have the body bag and send it to the undertaker to come and pick it up, or get your friends to take it where? To be cremated, or stick it in the garden, or whatever. You don't have to have a funeral, there is no legal obligation.
Yeah. There was a cartoon I saw somewhere.
Yes, I think you have to have permission from the local council, and it's not always easy to get.
Well, that's
all
right. Thank you for that.
There's a cartoon I saw on the internet somewhere, I don't know what it was. Anyway, the man saying, there's this chap lying in bed, you know, dying. And the chap says, well, the good news is that you may be pushing up a very rare kind of daisy.
Well, I'm
somewhat bewildered about how this arose.
Well, it is called coping with life's little difficulties.
Right, thank you. Yes. Well, that's death's little difficulties.
Another thing is. Maybe, I mean, you can even start, one starts even seeing life is eternal rather than, I mean, this is a reflection. Because things die, don't they? I mean, like we're experiencing consciousness, But and consciousness dies, then is life dead when we die? You know, and then so this is another thing to contemplate, is that maybe consciousness stops, you know, the body it doesn't operate anymore as one kind of organism, and it starts decaying, but life still's going on. And so this becomes more like a radio or a kind of something that's operating to pick up things, you know, it's a kind of sensitive formation that we can pick up things with. But it's and then the important thing is to understand to understand it rather than to be identified with it.
Do you mean life in the sense of energy still going on?
Yeah, it's like it seems this arising, ceasing out of the unconditioned seems to be, you know, it's the eternal or, I mean, this is where the mind stops. But you're getting beyond just the kind of very limited sense of yourself being somebody who was born and will die, and that death is the opposite to life. I'd say death is maybe the entrance to immortality.
What happens if you accidentally appear to accelerate, I knew somebody who accidentally blew his brains out, but he actually was messing around with a gun. Now, where's he got, what, I mean, I don't understand what's happened to this person, other than he's dead, but how does that kind of make sense on a sort of Buddhist kind of way?
Well, all you know is that if you watch your mind, desire tends to always be like to be looking for something. It's an energy that's always looking for something to connect to, and so I see that this is what passes on. Like people, take this to the death moment. If there's still desires operating, then that means that they're still, you know, they're still part of the universal system, seeking some kind of thing to connect to again. So the Buddhist idea of rebirth, and like Morris was talking about, is very much rather than a soul that kind of goes from one life to the next, is more desire operating. Like if you can watch it in your own mind, how like you could just go to your room after an evening, and you can see just the like desire is going to kind of putter around or do this or this, anything to, you know, if you're not aware, you start just doing things like going to the fridge or smoking a cigarette, just doing anything to following a desire for some kind of object to absorb into, and then you can see that this operates, you know, even, and desire will aim at anything available, you know, it's not like it needs this discriminative, whatever you can gratify desire with, it'll go to that, and then if you're, you know, if you're more discriminative and that, then you might develop kind of refined tastes and so forth, but it still operates maybe on a more refined level, and as you, but then the liberation is through understanding it, not through trying to get rid of it. Like, I mean, we tend to, like when we first started, we were trying to get rid of our desires. When I first started meditating, you know, the conditioned mind, my Christian mind, was desire always has a pejorative kind of quality, doesn't it? So you shouldn't have desires. And there was this tendency to want to suppress desires or get rid of them. And then, of course, that doesn't work because you make strong karma with suppression. The more you suppress something, the stronger it becomes. And so, like trying to get rid of something creates a strong bond with what you're trying to get rid of. Rather than resolving it, you're actually creating a strong connection. And that's why mindfulness is the way, rather than destroying evil. It's not trying to kill the devil, it's understanding the devil.
Well, my question seems to be I was going to change the subject altogether. So, I was just going to ask you to define the word reflection.
Could we hear the question?
The question is, I was going to ask Mr. Smeder to define the word reflection because he uses it rather a lot. And others don't use it, I don't think, as much as you do.
Well, I use it, is it's the ability of the mind to watch the conditions, to like contemplating. It can be contemplation or like observing, witnessing, and then reflecting on them means to acknowledge them, that they're this way, or to kind of examine them, and to not in a critical way, but merely as this is the way they are. Like to say, like an anger, when one's feeling angry, to reflect on it means to acknowledge its presence. It feels like this. And it, you know, you feel down here, or maybe a tension in your guts or something, and your reflection means you're noting it. Reflective awareness. So that you're using thought, reflective thought, rather than, say, proliferating thought or rational thought. So you're using your ability to think to kind of bring into consciousness the way it is. So, like, you can ask yourself questions like, what does anger feel like? You know, when you're feeling angry and you're feeling... And that, what is it, and you can reflect, what does it feel like? So that you're kind of reminding yourself to look at it rather than to indulge or suppress it. Or like a cold, like when the cold weather comes. When I first came to England, I would reflect on the cold. What is cold like? Because I tended to just react. You know, I don't like this. And then I would start just observing, what does cold feel like? What is coldness? Is it? So I didn't kind of bring myself to look at the feeling of it rather than be caught in just my habitual reaction to it, which was tending to be averse and to huddle and to kind of try to get out of it. And then that helped because then I could see the habit was one thing. This aversion and complaining, you know, complaining about the English weather was a kind of a habit. But then the actual experience, I began to not mind cold when I could see it as a condition rather than just be reacting to it. Contemplation like Vipassana, the contemplative practice, because you're taking something and examining it. Something not like a mystery in the Christian sense, but an actual experience doubt or worry. These things are you're contemplating them. You're bringing them into your consciousness. You're allowing them to be conscious, and in that, and then, as they're conscious, you can be aware of something that's you're conscious of. And awareness means that you're mindful of it. You can contemplate it in terms of Dhamma, as impermanent, as dukkha, as unsatisfying, and as anatta. And then the realization of its absence is a nirodha. So, and what I'm trying to do is trying to bring these noble truths into very simple experiences of life. Because, I mean, sometimes the way Vipassana is taught is, and people just never get it because they're expecting some kind of fantastic experience. And, you know, they're already anticipating Nirodha, Nibbana, some kind of mind-blowing experience. And they're kind of always on the edges of it, you know, taking retreats and so forth. And they never notice the ordinariness of it. And I think this is where, especially, you know, the way I've practiced, you're not kind of doing extreme things to have extreme experiences of the Four Noble Truths. You're actually using those as just kind of reminders to witness and be awake to the flow of life, which is not extreme at all. Like in monastic life, it's just so routine, day after day, the same thing, and kind of monotony, and where kind of extreme activities are usually forbidden, you're learning to accept and witness and learn from just the flow of daily life. And this is what Lungpo Cho was always kind of pointing to. I remember talking to a Vipassana teacher in the States and go on these 3 month retreats, and they really, you know, they say some people really experience Nirodha and some don't. And he said, I was nearly there. I was just about ready, just about ready to get it. And then I got the news that my father died. And then I had to stop. And he said, I have to go on another retreat. Hopefully I'll get it back.
Can I ask just a practical question? This afternoon I had to repel a child invader to my neighbor's garden. I was angry. Had I paused to observe my anger, a little bit of reflection, I wouldn't have the oomph to get that child to move really fast out of the garden. And this is a continual problem in the practical world. And I don't know how to marry a desire to be reflective, meditative, be, as it were, in tune with what really is there, and to do quite a lot of things to do with other people, which is part of my responsibility, which I feel I couldn't do if I was continually reflecting upon the situation and accepting it as there. This is obviously a continued conflict.
I mean, reflection doesn't mean you don't act, because I mean you can, like, sometimes there's an intuitive awareness that this, you know, that is operating, and sometimes one just has to trust. If one is doing something kind of in a spontaneous way, where say reactiveness is merely it's just from habit, and it's not particularly with a situation. It's always imposing something onto a situation. So in much of life, we have to act spontaneously, you know, and then learn from those actions. You can't, and then a lot of anger isn't, we don't act on it, because it's merely maybe from hurt feelings or just being annoyed or being offended by somebody, or being feeling self-pity. And these kind of negative states, then more and more we can resolve through reflecting on them and seeing them in terms of Dhamma. But still there's ability to respond to life in ways that might seem angry, but are, maybe that is the appropriate, you know, like to say to a child, to stop a child from going out into the motorway, is you can't just say, now watch your mind, and or you don't want to say, now dear, don't go out in that motorway, you might get hurt. With a child, you've got to say in a heavy way, don't you go out. And it's more, because on some levels that will leave the impression that will help that child to not do things it shouldn't. But it's also like like anger coming from, like when the only problem with anger is when we use it, when we're not mindful of it, and then we tend to abuse people, and that from our own selfishness, not out of real concern for them. And like I look back in my childhood, and I think when my father, like there's this attitude you shouldn't hit a child or spank them in any way. But I look back and I think my father, he didn't spank me very much, but when he did, it was always, you know, I realized I deserved it. I was being really unbearable. And I never felt he was hitting me out of aversion to me, or, you know, just from his own neurotic needs to brutalize him. He was actually trying to, you know, stop me from being a nasty, insensitive little brat. And I could accept that, because I knew, you know what you are. You know when you're driving your parents up the wall. And you don't mind being set straight. It's when it hurts when you're being hit, say, unfairly, or you don't know why. You know, they just come and kind of belt you one, and you don't know why it's happening. That's very, you know, harmful.
Well, my little dog, Carl, only got, you know, slapped really hard once. That was when he was chewing up my books, and he just didn't do it again. But once we had this staircase down to the kitchen from the lounge where some bookshelves were, once Florence told me he took a book out of the bookcase, the lower shelf, and didn't chew it or anything, he just threw it down the stairs to her.
He was keeping his end up, wasn't he?
Yeah. He had a real doggy sense of humour.
My question I want to come back to a bit, though, because really it was meant to be exhibiting the continual conflict I find between accepting things how they are and wanting to do something about things. This is a continual conflict, surely, which anybody that follows the Buddhist way must.
But look, like the way things are is, it's not a kind of, it's not a passive kind of state where you don't do anything. But it is recognizing at this moment, this is the way it is, and because that's the truth, and then we can respond to this moment either through action or passivity, and that comes through mindfulness rather than through a fixed view. Like sometimes, I mean, if you trust in your own intuitive abilities and sensitivity, then more and more we find we can respond, the spontaneity in our life. We act, but also we can also not act. But that is not a position we take. Like passive resistance is, or the idea of passivity or non-violence or inaction or whatever is an ideal, but as a position, it tends to, you know, be, doesn't work. I mean, you can't do that. But reflection is being able to learn how to more or less have confidence and faith and trust in the purity of your own of your being, of your mind, and not be just caught into an endless kind of confused state through attachment to ideals and that, because so many kind of idealistic people, altruistic people, are continually kind of unable to do anything because they're confused by their own high-mindedness, and they don't have that ability to act spontaneously. They lose it, and like you can see in what's happening in Yugoslavia. Right. How nobody knows what to do, and it's always just a total, you know, kind of confusion of them and us, and who's right and who's wrong, what's going to happen, so that there's no kind of direct action possible. But it's always a risk, too. And but also you learn. You know, you can. That's where you always learn from your experiences. You reflect and the results of your actions. Like, you don't always act right. You may not always do the right thing. But then you learn from that. And you can see maybe where you got carried away, you misread something, or you kind of lost it. And then you can learn from that, so that it doesn't happen again, or at least it doesn't happen so often. And through that, you can, you know, where sometimes, you know, I've suffered a lot from feeling guilty about making mistakes, and then getting lost in the sense of self-criticism and lack of worth, because I make mistakes and I don't do everything right. And then there's a kind of pusillanimous wimp. It says, oh, I want to go away into my cave and not have to be involved in life anymore. And then I see that the real joy of this life is being able to learn from it. And we all learn usually from doing it wrong. It's for, you know, we tend to do things wrong first. Or not quite as good as they should be. But if we keep mindful of it and reflect on it, then we learn from that. It's like learning a foreign language. You can't, you know, you can hardly say anything right in the beginning, but through learning and reflecting and keep going, then you eventually can speak another language fluently, or playing a musical instrument. Anything, any learning comes through learning from your mistakes, from what you do wrong, from the clumsiness, from the foolishness, rather than thinking I'm a hopeless case because I've done foolish things.
I think that we have overrun a bit, so perhaps any more questions could be taken up with Arjun Sabedo while I'm getting him a cup of coffee, and the rest of us could also get a cup, and hopefully we can meet for meditation in about half an hour's time. Thank you very much.